Hello, and welcome to another episode of Breadcrumbs. Today, I am joined by Griffin. Griffin is an organizer, an investigator, a teacher, a overall force for good in the universe. He's also a hatless wonder. Griffin, how are you doing?
That's awesome. That might be the most unique introduction I've had. Thank you. I'm good. Super happy to be here. Thanks for that. I do try to be all those things. I don't know if I am all the time, but definitely aspire to.
Yeah, as long as you're, you know, some of them most of the time, you're probably headed in the right direction. You can't be all at once, obviously.
I appreciate your endorsement.
This podcast has been one I've been wanting to do for a long time. You and I have known each other in some way, shape, or form for years now. We've worked in a lot of the same communities or, you know, parallel to each other in the overall OSINT and investigative space. You're someone that I just love to talk to. So I said, hey, let's actually record one of these conversations.
I appreciate it, man. It's been great getting to know you over the years and seeing all the stuff that you've been doing and the folks that you work with. And definitely a lot of kindred spirit energy happening there with the whole OSINT for good and doing things for the community. I think that you and I definitely share that for sure.
Yeah. And you have like so much just investigative experience, both in the real world, in the online space, and the intersection of the two. I really would like us to talk through like what I describe as fundamental investigative techniques. So these would be things that whether you're on the street or you're on Facebook, like these are techniques or skills or things you need to understand to be an effective investigator. So how does that sound?
That sounds like my favorite topic in the world.
Awesome. Let's start with pivoting. So if you're new to the OSINT space, you're going to hear this like thrown around a lot, and like, shame on us as people that have maybe been around for a little bit. Like we just throw that out like it's easy or like it's going to make sense to a brand new person. Sure. Like, oh yeah, just pivot. Like,
well, yeah.
What does it even mean? What the hell are we talking about? Like, what is?
Hey. It's such a fundamental thing that you kind of forget that it's something that you had to learn along the way at some point yourself. and what you do pivoting wise and how you pivot and things like that, that evolves every day. The more you learn, the more you see, the more experience you have, right? Because the things that I do nowadays when I'm pivoting off of a piece of data, it doesn't look like what I did 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And so that pivot, that sort of starting in one place and looking to another for the correlation, for the jump, you know, for the next phase of the rabbit trail you're going to follow or the, you know, the hole you're going to go down, however you want to characterize it. that's something that you evolve as a practitioner. That's why I love it so much, because I can constantly be learning and picking up new skills and new techniques and maybe new tools and resources. And then in my mind, I have sort of this catalog of things that I can do with a piece of data or a piece of information. But what really makes it special for me and what makes it fun is that it's driven entirely by the human element. It doesn't matter how many tools and resources and things you know about, or, you know, how many buttons you've clicked or bookmarks you have saved and all that kind of stuff. If your brain doesn't bring that curiosity and you don't have that drive, that compelling feeling to go to chase those leads and to connect those dots and stuff, then you don't do the work and you don't do the pivoting and you don't find the answer. And for me, that's the part that I really love is just that sort of curiosity, that problem solving that comes along with just digging your way through data and making those connections.
Absolutely. And I like that you touched on the human element, because AI, LLMs, machine learning, whatever's hot right now, still hasn't gotten to the point where it can replace that human experience, that human intuition. It could certainly help. I use AI in my investigations, and it's an asset if you know how to use it. But we're still at a point as investigators where we have to recognize things and we have to be able to move from that thing to something else. Like that's what a pivot is you have a piece of information or a set of information in front of you, and you as the investigator know, hey, I can take that piece of information and go somewhere else and find more data points. And along the way, hopefully you answer that question that is the focus of your investigation or questions. It's going to look different for every single investigation. You know, you hit on your own investigations looking different this week than last week or today than 5 years ago. I wonder, though, if we could talk at a high level, like what are some general strategies for pivoting? How do you like recognize pieces of information that might send you in a different direction, whether that's in like a real life, a real world investigation or an online investigation?
Sure. So for me, I sort of have this, I don't know, at times I refer to it as a bit of a problem because it makes me do a lot of work, but I have this thing where I don't take anything at face value, and I always want to know what's going on, what it means, what's behind it, that kind of thing. So when I examine information, I am always like testing it and stretching it and connecting it and doing the things with it to see where it might lead. And when I think about like social media research, for example, you know, when I land on somebody's profile in a social media environment, I want to know everything. I want to know who said what on what photo. I want to know who clicked like as opposed to heart. I want to know who linked to something else, some other content. I want to know who put them in a photo, because all those things mean something different. And I don't know yet at that point what's going to you know, be the thing that leads me down the road towards the answer that I'm seeking or towards the information that I need. And so I don't make any assumptions. Because when I start making those assumptions, that's where bias creeps in. And I start only seeing the things that I'm seeking out, and I miss other clues and stuff like that. And that's what I really enjoy about that aspect of it. I'll give you an example. Just the other day, I was working on a case where I had a piece of information about a person. I had their email address, and part of what I was trying to do was expand their digital presence, create a report of all the places where they have a digital persona accounts and things like that. Because in the law enforcement world, there's things that can be done to gain information from the sources. So I need to find them. Well, as I'm working with the one single selector that I have, that one email, and I'm using tools and investigative methodologies to try and find connections to online accounts and data sources and things like that, I came up with a series of connections to this email address that at first glance would seem kind of uninteresting, unimportant, right? It's just presence on a number of different platforms, some of them very common, some of them maybe innocuous or with no, you know, relevant details seemingly. But as I scanned it and I went back through and I took the time to examine each one of those things individually, because, you know, here comes that problem that I mentioned earlier where I can't resist. I flipped one of those rocks, and it led me to realizing that they were using a variation of their username from the email address on a particular site. And that's a behavior that I recognize, right? We all do that kind of digital behavior where we keep elements of something that means something to us when we create a name online, a profile name, a username, things like that. And I recognized that this is a little bit different than the one I'm working with. And I took that piece of data and I said, okay, I wonder if I can correlate this to some email addresses that might be different than the one I started with. And so I started playing around with some different tools using that additional username and some other things that I knew. And eventually I came up with several email addresses that I knew were active because I can see their presence, you know, through some online databases, you know, breach data and things like that. And then I can do other correlation. Eventually I determine, okay, these other four email addresses that I'm able to put together are related to the same person who's a missing person that I'm trying to help track down. And, you know, by doing that sort of thorough examination of the initial work, but then also a little bit of guesswork and a little bit of understanding people's digital behavior, I'm able to come up with these potential additional accounts for this person and then validate that finding you know, using sources and methods that I know will tell me, okay, this is going to be the person because, you know, they have certain characteristics that are similar. The profile image is the same, things like that. They give me a higher degree of confidence. So, yeah, that's sort of how I look at that kind of pivoting approach and being able to use that data to jump off to other places.
Yeah, I like that you hit on, you know, going into a set of data and having some assumptions, having some biases, like, oh, that's not important, moving on, because you've already made up in your mind like what that smoking gun's going to look like or what that next pivot point is going to look like. And that is very dangerous. Whether you've been investigating for a week or a decade, like, that will ruin your investigation. I can tell you from painful personal experience, the biggest quote unquote breaks I've ever had in the stuff I've worked on hasn't been me actually finding something new. It was me going back and realizing I missed something at the very beginning that I thought wasn't a big deal, or, okay, that's just noise. I'm going to move on to the next thing that I think is important. And that is a painful lesson that we all have to learn. I just hope everyone listening to this learns it faster than I have.
I've been there.
Yes. I guess, like, I would encourage, regardless of whether it's a Facebook page or, you know, a forum post or just something you're looking at in real life, think about, and I don't know if I'm making this up as I'm going or if I actually heard this somewhere else, but atomic pieces of data. So atomic in this sense being the smallest unit you can possibly have. So if you're on a Facebook post, okay, that's not atomic a Facebook profile, because it's made up of posts. Okay, so now let's dig deeper. So now the posts, is that atomic? Well, not really, because the posts have who posted it, who liked it, who commented on it. So once you really drill down into those atomic pieces of data, you realize how much data is actually in front of you on a simple Facebook profile, a Twitter profile, an Instagram post. Is made up of all these different little atomic pieces of data. And once you realize that and try to eliminate your own bias, you realize how much potential information is actually in front of you, and then start sifting through it for pivot points.
Yep. And never make any assumptions about what it's going to be, because you never know. I can't tell you the number of times in social media research where I've found people's additional profiles. So many people have multiple profiles on the same platform, and for a number of reasons, right? Some of them are as simple as, like, this is from when I was younger and now I have a different profile. Or maybe, when I'm investigating a criminal, a lot of times, like, oh, this person went to jail for a number of years and they, you know, lost connection to their previous account, or they lost the phone it was associated with, things like that. And you never know when that little connection that, you know, the person who liked that post that has the same last name of them just opens up an entire world for you, right? Because I'm going to go over to that person's profile and I'm going to see who they're connected to that shares the name of my person and see if I can find that more recent account. And it's that sort of like spider web, but also kind of hopping out and hopping back in approach to, especially to Socmint, the social media intelligence that really pays off a lot of times. And the better you understand people's digital behaviors, then the better questions you can ask yourself about what could this mean and where could I go with it.
Yeah. And something I've always been kind of conflicted on, because they're like, I've seen myself fall into two different schools of thought when it comes to like interrogating a set of data in front of you. And I describe it as going deep or going wide. When you land on a social media page, we'll just say a Facebook page, like, what's your approach? Like, do you try to get like a high level view of the entire profile before you start spiraling down into posts and likes and comments? Or do you just take it one piece of data at a time, one post at a time, and then kind of like recursively come back up to the profile once you've dug as far as you can dig?
So for me, it always depends on whatever my question is that I'm trying to answer. And really that sort of transcends all OSINT work, really, is you have to keep the question front of mind as far as what you're trying to answer, right? So I do a lot of work in missing persons cases. And when I'm viewing social media profiles for those people, most often I'm looking for, to start out with, I'm looking for activity and the time of that activity. Because if I'm able to determine that there's activity on the account past the time of disappearance, well, that's an important factor in one of those investigations, right? Now, those are few and far between. But some of the other things that I'm going to be looking for is activity by other people that are connected to that person, currently connected to that person and recently connected to that person, because those people are the ones who are making the posts that have everybody talking about things. Well, I heard that person's in XYZ, or I heard that person's with so and so, or things like that. So I'm looking at that recent activity. I want to view their content for the purpose of correlating it with other online presence, because the reality is that if I'm looking for a missing teenager, for example, a lot of teenagers are not going to have a very robust Facebook presence, if at all, because teenagers, by and large, have moved on to other social media over the years. It's less popular. So if I need to find that person on Instagram, that's a completely different ball game than finding somebody on Facebook, right? Go to Facebook, you type a name in the search box, and you can filter options based on where they went to school, what town they're in, other things like that. And there's some intuitive stuff happening behind the scenes in a Facebook search that isn't being replicated in Instagram, where it's just you're searching the text of their username or the text of their display name, and those can be different, obviously. And the display name or username that they have on Instagram a lot of times won't correlate with their given name. And knowing that kind of digital behavior of people, then when I land on their Facebook account, I'm looking for mentions of other social media that I can go pivot to. I'm looking for friends and family of theirs with unique names that are easier to find in a place like Instagram by their name, so that I can then back into this person through a following list. Because, if you're Griffin on Facebook, but you are Fuzzy Bunny 123 on Instagram, there's no connection to those two things, and you have to find that through the friends and family and close circles and things like that. So to circle back to my process for looking at a social media page like a Facebook, for example, it starts with what's my question I'm trying to answer, and then I go to the type of content that's going to help me answer that question, right? So if it's recent post activity, whether it's I need to see photographs of this person for reasons, I need to see what they look like or who they're with and things like that. or I'm looking for other data points that I need, like hometown information, schools, other affiliations, things like that. So.
I'm really glad that you brought up like keeping your question in mind, because if you forget why you're doing an investigation, you're going to spend a lot of time uncovering a lot of interesting information that might not be relevant to the investigation whatsoever. So cool, you got to find out a bunch of interesting things, but you're no closer to doing your job than you were an hour, a day, a week, a month ago, depending on how long you've kind of been spiraling. And I'm completely going to contradict myself. I just said, try to remove your own biases. Every piece of information is important. That can also go wrong in a completely different direction. Some pieces of information don't matter. In fact, I'll go so far as to say most pieces probably won't matter. There's probably much more noise than signal in any investigation, no matter what you're investigating or where that investigation takes place. Do you have any thoughts, experiences, rules of thumb to share with the rest of us? Like, how do you know when maybe you're going in the wrong direction, or how do you know when maybe you've dug deep enough on one piece of data, it's time to back up, like come back up to the surface and see what else was at that starting point?
You've touched on a very personal topic to me. So I am absolutely a do as I say, not as I do type person in this regard. because I will, in full transparency, I will absolutely dedicate whatever amount of my life I need to finding the answer to something and go however deep I have to go down the rabbit hole to find what I need. Granted that it's important enough. And most of the work that I'm doing these days is the type of work that is important enough to dedicate that to. So, I don't say that lightly, but people will joke with me that I have a tendency to keep going well past the point of we got what we need because I just like to find everything. But the reality is, to your point, you need to answer a question. And that question, a lot of times, can be answered with a subset of all of the data that's available. And I guess, from an analyst standpoint, it's important to know how to tell that story and know how to pull out the details that are important. And then you also have to know how to communicate that to whoever the stakeholder is. And that looks totally different across different careers and different types of reporting and casework and things like that. So, if you're doing just a catch-all type investigation where you want everything about this person, right? Maybe it's a missing person case, right? We'll take a Trace Labs scenario, for example. You have a missing person. You don't know what may be relevant. So your goal right now is to gather up everything. So you take it all. At some point, though, someone has to look at all that data and make those decisions about what's relevant and what's not, what to follow and what to leave behind. And if you're not the person in the process that should do that, that's fine. Your part of the process may be gathering, collecting, making the type of analysis that allows you to expand your collection to other data sources. But for me, when I give a report nowadays, I will prioritize certain findings at the very top of the report. It comes with a real quick summary of this is what you'll see here, and then what I consider to be actionable findings based on my experience, working in these types of cases. And I feel comfortable being able to bubble up those things to the agency that I'm reporting to because having worked enough of these cases and seen, what's available, I know where I would start and I know where a lot of people start. But if I wasn't the right person for that process, I would ask someone else on my team who was to be able to do that for me. Because, like you said, not all of that data is going to be the useful data that gives you the answer, right? I just was on a case call right before we did this. And in that case, we developed pages and pages of information about this person. And I boiled down really six findings to the agency of like, these are the high priority actionable findings that I can see. And those priorities are based on things like who has the most data about people? What kind of companies have the most data about people? Was something more recently used or updated than something else that can be valuable information? In this case, I prioritize things like apps connected to financial institutions. Because in this particular case, there is a possibility that somebody's financial records are going to be of great importance in the question that we need to answer. I should have said at the beginning that I have to be intentionally vague about some of the details of things because we are talking about real casework. But everything that I just said there still keeps the investigative question at the front of the mind of what are we trying to answer? What are we trying to do?
Maybe to circle us back to where we started this conversation, I definitely ragged on us, like the people that have been around for a bit, not a long time. Like I'm still fairly new. I ragged on us for just saying, oh yeah, just pivot or, find your pivot points. How do you know? And where I'm going with this is, let's just say you're not doing like a Tracelab CTF, so it's not like a timed event. And also, like, you might not have like a so-called flag list. You're just investigating something, trying to answer a question. How do you know like what's pivotable? How do you know what's worth pivoting on? Is it just one long trial and error, or do you kind of have to like take your time and say, what could I do with this piece of information? If the answer is nothing, okay, on to the next piece.
Yeah. Well, so there are different ways that you can build that skill. And I tell this to people a lot. I teach in a lot of different capacities, open source intelligence work. And there are ways, like, for example, you can get books, you can attend training. You can watch free videos. There's lots of different places to learn about how to work with data in terms of open source intelligence. What I will say is that that process takes an amount of time, and that amount of time can either be stretched or compressed based on doing certain things. And I'm not saying that one is better than the other, because it's not a one size fits all approach. But let's say that you work for a company that gives you, you know, infinite budget money to buy whatever training and resources you need to be the best at your job. Okay, great. So then you can go out there and you can find really capable, highly skilled training institutions, courseware and things that people have taken that have a good reputation, books and other sources that are kind of like that condensed source, somebody else did the thinking and organizing to put this all together for me type of information. And then you consume that information and learn from that process. That's not in the cards for everybody, right? We don't all have that kind of infinite budget. So then you start to stretch that to include things like free resources. There's loads of great blogs online, videos from people showing tips and tricks and tools and things like that. There's actually too much of that stuff online if that's going to be your only source of learning, and it's going to take you a long time to consume a lot of it for a smaller ROI in terms of quality and what you get out of it. And I'm not saying that in a right or wrong sort of way. I'm just saying it sort of like factually, there's a lot of noise in that, in those kind of signals. So you have that as a possibility. But the point for me is that you can learn a lot of things through the skills and teachings of others about what you can do with certain kinds of data. And that will take some people so far. And then you have to go out there and do it. Now, for me, I'm very much a hands-on, eyes-on, like I have to feel it to understand it, to learn it. I really, really struggle with watching a lecture or reading a book and learning that way. I find myself having to go back and rewatch or go back and relearn. What really clicks for me as a student is when I see it being used and I get that sort of tangible example of the time that you can take that username and I can see on the screen that they're connecting it to an email and they're running this query and they're finding the data. And then I see the account, like my brain holds on to that stuff in a way that it just doesn't with book learning and other ways. And because I know that about myself, when I try to look for situations where I can be a student, I really gravitate towards people that I know teach that way, because I'm going to get stuff out of them. A great example is a person named Stephen Harris, Nick's Intel, former OSINT Curious Project guy. I love when he teaches something because he does such a great job of breaking down the complexities of something into chunks that I can manage as a non-technical person, but then also shows me how it's working on the screen. And I can see it being used like in real life in an investigative capacity. And I remember things about talks that he gave years ago that I still do. And if I read a book last week on something, or watched a lecture, like a dry lecture with just bullet points on the screen or whatever, I'm not retaining any of that stuff. So if you are a person out there looking to learn OSINT or develop your skills, you got to understand yourself first if you want to get the most out of what you're going to consume, and understand how you need to learn, and then go look for things that you think are going to give you that kind of optimal experience. And I will encourage people that if you're serious about something and you have the means to do it, you can invest money in somebody who's done the work and research for you to put that training together, whether it be a book or an online class or a class in an institution that you physically attend. There's lots of options there. And if you can do those things, then you can accelerate your learning.
Yeah. And I'll say from personal experience, kind of a mixed bag. I think experience is the best teacher, but if you're only learning from your experiences, you've really kind of limited your learnings. You're only going to get better at this one thing that you're doing. But at the same mm-hmm. time, if you only ever watch videos, take classes, you know, go to conferences, if that's all you ever do, you're going to learn a lot, but you're not going to learn any of the application. So I would encourage people to do both. Anytime you have the chance to do it yourself, please do. But also realize that there's a ton of great information out there that you're going to need to constantly be ingesting to stay, you know, at the top of your game. And that's what's, it's fun, but it's also exhausting about investigative work, about OSINT work, or even about maybe information security in general, is it's always changing, like daily. And you could find yourself, you know, kind of playing catch up pretty quick in your respective field if you're not, you know, on those social media feeds, if you're not in those information sharing groups, if you're not reading books, watching videos, going to conferences. It can be exhausting. It can be a lot to deal with, but you know, it's a never-ending process. Like, you don't just learn OSINT and then you're good the rest of your life. You do have to keep at it for as long as you want to keep investigating.
Oh yeah. Yeah. As somebody who is constantly trying to keep a pulse on what's going on in the OSINT community, I'm someone who has gotten really good at saying no to myself when it comes to learning stuff. And when I see something that, for example, I see a blog post that dives into a platform that I'm not super familiar with, or a service that I'm not super familiar with that I may need someday, but I don't currently, I may bookmark that and categorize it and have it to reference later. But I tell myself no right now, because I know that I have limited time and limited capacity to take on new things. And it's not that I want to forget that that exists for when I need it, because, by the way, there is absolutely nothing wrong in OSINT with going and learning as you do when you need to, because there's way too much out there for any of us to be an expert at everything. And so I say no to that and hold off to the side. There's other times where I see stuff that I just flat out say, oh, that looks neat, but I'm not going to learn it, because I know that it's like just never going to come up in my life as far as something that I need to do in my work. And that's okay. And I'm happy to say that, because that means that I've saved that time to be able to dedicate to something that's closer to my projects and my tasks and the skills that I need.
Yes. Understanding that time is a finite resource is going to be your first step towards your OSINT education, or really education in anything. You know, time is your most valuable resource, so please spend it wisely. What made me even think of us like getting together and having like this talk specifically, was actually inspired by a blog post that you did. It was just a run-of-the-mill email scam, and you decided, hey, let's just dig into this and see what's going on. Like, most of us would just delete it and move on with our lives. Not Griffin. Griffin decided to go deep. And
yeah.
I thought that there were so many good pivot points, because it wasn't just like, oh, like it wasn't a straightforward investigation. You went some interesting directions and you pivoted off different pieces of information. And that's what really made me start thinking about this talk specifically. So if you're game for story time or kind of a recap with some bullet points, I think everyone listening would really enjoy it.
Yeah, of course. I love telling those stories. I don't know why. I really can't explain some of the things that I do in my head, but for some reason I got one of those emails one day in my spam folder that was like the, you know, my husband died and left you $4.6 million. You know, yada yada. Email me back so that I can start scamming you for money. And I was like, cool. I have always wondered if I could figure out who's on the other side of one of these things. And I wonder what would happen if I engaged with this person, maybe tried to elicit some information from them and just see where it goes, right? Because I have no idea where this may or may not lead at this point. And so I spin up a research account that I have elsewhere, not connected to where I received the email, because I'm absolutely certain they shotgun that to, you know, thousands and thousands of people probably. And I reached out to the entity, and I had a particular persona that I was portraying, the persona of the non-technical older person who is interested in in receiving money and doesn't really know how to work the systems that they're on very well, because I figured that they were looking for such a fish, if you will. And so we started a dialogue, and they tried to elicit information from me, including things like, you know, driver's license information and stuff like that, right? Because I have to prove who I am. And along the way, I was able to get the person to click on a link that was specifically crafted to grab their IP address. And that was something that I don't often do. I mean, I guess often might even be generous. I like rarely, if ever, would have to do, but I knew that it existed. I did a little bit of learning on it, set it up, provided the link in a way that made it look like I was sharing a photo of my driver's license, like they wanted, like they expected, got them to click, got an IP address. And then I was off to the races, because now I know exactly what to do, right? So take the email or the IP address. Of course, the emails they're using are all just spun up for them to be able to do this, right? They're not connected to them in real life. And using the email address, I was able to uncover a connected person through that IP address, analyze the IP address and see that it was a residential IP. You know, even using things like I know what you download, I can see that they're torrenting movies and stuff like that to the house, right? And so I did all this really to no end, right? Because this person's halfway around the world and nothing's going to come of this. But then I was curious about what they wanted with me. How were they going to get the money out of me? Because at this point, they hadn't really elicited any kind of, you know, financial transfer or anything from me. And so I carried on with them, and eventually they asked for what's called an advance fee scam, where they try to get you to pay an amount of money up front to receive the big money later. So, you know, they presented that option to me as the $100,000+ in interest has been accruing, and for the meager fee of $1,280, you can have it all, right? So I said, yeah, give me the information so I can pay you. And they provided me with banking information, which at first I thought was going to be fake, because the name that came along with it, I'll just say it was Bob Smith, right? Just to make it up. But it was such a common name that I thought, well, this is fake. But then I'm like, wait a minute, if they really want to get my money, they can't give me fake banking information. I wonder if this Bob Smith person is the real deal. And so I had to get more information from them to be able to work with it, because I can't work with a bank account number. I asked them if they had any access to like a financial app that they could send me the connection, you know, the phone number or email address for, and they shot me back an email for PayPal. And I used that to identify the guy, quote unquote, Bob Smith, in real life, and then use some geographic information, his profile information, what I found from his email address to identify him as an elderly man that lived here in the United States, most certainly not connected in any way to this scam as a participant, a knowing participant, likely the victim of a money muling scam or some other type of like account compromise or something else. And ultimately I packaged all that information up and provided it to the feds so that they could take care of that victim, right? At the end of the day, I doubt they went overseas and got the guy that was trying to get my $1,280. But at the same time, there's a victim here in the States who, you know, hopefully is no longer a victim.
So lots of really cool pivots in there. And, you know, you kind of like, you know, gloss over it like it's no big deal. But that was some really interesting, just like seeing what was in front of you and saying, hey, what could I do with this? So you got a scammy email and said, what could I do with this? Okay, well, let's engage and find out. And then you got an IP address. What can I do with this? Okay, now you found out they were in, you know, a specific part of the world. And it's like, okay, well, I can't do much with that, but let's just see what else I can do. Okay, they've now given me a PayPal account. What can I do with that? And you turned a scammy email from halfway around the world into an elderly person in the U.S. that was most likely being taken complete advantage of by this, you know, criminal, you know, organization. That's really cool. Some really cool pivots in there. And like, I wanted you to tell that story for the audience, because it really does showcase like just seeing what's in front of you and taking the time to think through what could I do with that. So good story.
Thanks, man. Yeah, that's what it's all about. You never know what what's going to be relevant. And that's where, building up your skills in how you work with the different types of common data points, the email, IP, phone number, name, username, all that stuff that comes up across a myriad of investigative types. When you have that toolbox, that library of things that you can do with those different data points, then you can really focus on the power of the human mind that's going to see those intangible things, that's going to make those connections, those jumps and things that machines can't replicate for us, and put those pieces together because you have those skills. And then you can keep building on those skills as new tools come out or as new techniques evolve and things like that. Like I said at the beginning, I'm doing things right now that I didn't do last year or 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And, come see me next year. I'll have something new for what I'm doing. Just it's constant growth.
My kind of final thought on pivoting is no matter what you're doing, what you're investigating, where you're investigating, you're gonna have information in front of you. You can almost always turn that information into more information, and that's what pivoting is. The tricky part as an investigator is deciding, is that more information that you're pivoting to actually going to be useful? So, part of that will come with time and experience. Part of it's just going to come with luck. Sometimes maybe your first pivot was the only one that you needed. But just if I had to summarize what is pivoting, it's turning the information you have in front of you into more information. And once you start to just abstract it like that, you'll start to see all information as good information.
Absolutely. There's really no limit to what you can do except for your own creativity and curiosity. I'll give you a great example of that. In terms of an investigative story, there was a time where my goal was to locate where a photo was taken in the world. This is no context comes with it. This is part of a very, very serious investigation. The kind of investigation that necessitated that myself and a number of other people spent probably 6 to 8 months investigating to figure this out. And so we have this location depicted in a photo, and we need to know where it is because there's a victim on the other side of that photo that needs help, right? So we, as a team, go through a ton of research. I mean, I could spend the next hour talking about it. Eventually, come up with photos from that same location, posted online by a member of the family associated with this house. We think, okay, we've got them, right? Now we know where to look, where to go. But this isn't a part of the world where you can't just pull up white pages and Google to get somebody's address, right? So I still don't physically know where that building is. I know now the family associated with the building. And so we thought about what are the different ways that we can come up with where this is. We know what country it is. We know generally what part of the country it is, a massive country. And eventually, I said to myself, well, we're going to have to use satellite imagery to find this location. But we're dealing with ground photos that people have taken, candid photos that they posted on their social media. And so I said, well, what if I did a bunch of research into this whole family, everybody I can find, every platform, everywhere, all the years back, and grab every photo that they all took at this one family residence that they visited over the years? And maybe we could use that to mock up what it's going to look like from above. So I spent an entire weekend going through all of this, and I pulled together 146 photos from all of the family's social media over all the years, all the times they visited this person's house. And we took those photos, and a person in our group put together like a simplistic diagram of shapes of the building, of the carport, of the outbuilding, of the pergola, where the sidewalk would be, how it runs perpendicular to the road, all that kind of stuff, set it all up. And then through some research using SunCalc and the clock on the wall on a particular day, we're able to determine the building's orientation to the road. So what direction it's going to be facing in that part of the world in order for the sun to have come across it in that way. So I have all this information now. I know that the road's going to run this particular direction. I know the house is going to be on this particular side of the road facing this direction. I know roughly what it's going to look like from above with all these buildings. And we go and we do the research and we can't find this place. And I remember from all the social media research that I did that one of the candid photos that was posted in somebody's account was from a get together, we'll say, a reunion of sorts. And that reunion led me to believe that they were going to be near where the institution that was referenced in that reunion. I can't say any more specifically about that, but the institution referenced there has a physical location. And maybe the home of this family was nearby that physical location where they were participating in this reunion, right? Using that piece of information, just an 8-minute walk from where that was, we're able to nail down that physical location as best we can from kind of a crummy satellite, you know, kind of a hazy satellite view. It looked like it was probably right. Now I've got to come up with a way to verify that on the ground. There's no street view in this part of the world. I can't go walk Google Maps or anything like that. So I had to go out there and I decided to go look for people who in that part of the world ride around on motorbikes with GoPro cameras and record themselves driving all the streets of these different cities and towns and put them on video streaming services. Eventually, I found a person who created and posted a video in that part of that country, in that part of the world. And I watched that thing, the hours of it, until I got to the part where he turned down the street that I was waiting for. And I got to pause it right in front of that house. And I can see all the elements of the driveway and the signage and the posts and everything that's still there, all the structural elements. And boom, I have my location. And along the way, doing all those things, I had no, like, it's not typical to have to mock up an overhead satellite view of something. It's not typical to have to research and find somebody driving around on a moped. I never did any of that kind of stuff before, but I knew I had a problem to solve, and keeping that problem front of mind and just asking myself repeatedly, like, what could I do with this? Where could I find information? Where could I go and look? That just led me to be curious and be tenacious and not want to give up. And eventually, with the support of other people around me who are awesome at what they do, we were able to collectively get to this answer, get to this location.
Nice. It's an awesome story. Yeah, that's like very like Tom Clancy, like this is, you know, like,
it's,
you know, in
forever.
Well, yeah. So, and like, that's the thing in real life, that investigation took 6 to 8 months, you know, on the next season of Jack Ryan, it takes about, you know, half a day.
Yeah, of course. But that's what's possible. And that's just, I mean, the thing that I like working about, working with the people that I do is that they have such varied and awesome skill sets in all these different areas. You know, people with backgrounds in law enforcement, private sector, military intelligence, police, business management, and all these things. And everybody's got a unique perspective. And you never know when somebody's background or perspective is going to be the game changer for what you're working on, right? I want to be surrounded with people that are very different than me. The absolute last thing I want to do is work with a bunch of Griffins, right? Because I'm only ever going to be as good as Griffin is. And while I might be good at some things that we do in open source intelligence, it's such a wide field that there's tons of things that I suck at, you know, or that I don't know anything about. And if I'm surrounded with experts that have their own dynamic skill set and our diagrams overlap somewhat, but not all the way, our Venn diagrams, well, now those people have made our collective response stronger. And we're better, we get better results, and I get to learn, right?
Yeah, and I'm glad that you hit on that. I would say anyone out there listening, if you have the opportunity, don't investigate alone. Sometimes, I mean, maybe if that's just what you're doing and you're doing it by yourself and that's just the way it is, that's not a problem. You can still be an amazing investigator solo. But if you have the option, or if you have the opportunity to work with a team, it's going to pay dividends for exactly the reason you just described.
No doubt about it, man. I am nothing if not for the people that I've been around. That's for sure.
I think that's all I had on my list. Anything else you wanted to touch on?
I'll tell you what, I am extremely blessed in terms of what I've been privy to in my life, what I've been given access to, and who I've worked with, and how I've been able to learn and be with great people. Sometimes I really wonder how I got here and if I'm supposed to be here. So if you're one of those people that's sitting out there thinking that same thing, or you don't know where you should be or if you deserve to be somewhere, you do. Okay. I promise you do. And if somebody tells you they don't, it's only because they're not where they want to be.
Well, Griffin, this has been an amazing conversation. And, an hour or so after the podcast introduction, I stand by everything I said. Organizer, teacher, force for good in the universe. This has been amazing. If people wanted to track you down online to learn from you the way that I've been able to, where would they find you online?
What a creepy way to say that, Tom. If people want to track me down online, I'm in a lot of places, and I love to network with people, and I love to meet people in the OSINT community, the OSINT for Good folks. I'm on LinkedIn. You can find me on there, Griffin Glenn. We'll put that in the notes. If you're on Twitter, Hatless Wanderer with the number one in it, because I didn't have a lot of foresight when I made that name. And I also, my day job at the National Child Protection Task Force, where I serve as the chief investigations officer, is really the thing that I'm the most proud of. If we're doing something in the world that's making a difference, and you would like to contribute to that, it is a nonprofit, and we do always look for support from the community in a variety of different ways. So please check out that organization on your socials. And then I also work closely with Micah Hoffman, who many people will know as Web Breacher. He and I are co-owners of a company called My OSINT Training. And within My OSINT Training, we do training videos, in-person trainings, things like that. And really the idea there is to bring accessible, affordable OSINT learning to people, high quality stuff that we're proud of, that we feel like connects with a lot of the audience in terms of what they need and what they can use. And that's another community space where I've really been amazed by the people that come together and from all walks of life, all around the world, to get involved in learning together and stuff. So check us out over there as well. That's myosint.training. And thanks, Tom. I really appreciate being on. Big fan of you, of the stuff that you've done, and the people at Trace Labs and all that you guys have done to try and make the world better. So hats off to you.
Thank you, and I look forward to our next conversation, and someday we'll get to hang out in person.
You know it.
I'll see you around. This has been another episode of Breadcrumbs. If you'd like to learn more, you can find us online at tracelabs.org, on Twitter at Trace Labs. But if you really want to find us, just follow the breadcrumbs.